This is a Hubris Mosaic production. All views expressed herein are those of the individuals and do not represent Hubris Mosaic.
Hello, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Matt.
And together we are...
Cousins of Hope!
Cousins of Hope! I was waiting for you to go first.
Oh, well. It works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Positivity, it sees you through everything.
This week's subject is all about learning, and our quote is from Dr. Seuss, who said, "The more that you read, the more things you will know. The more that you learn, the more places you'll go."
This is very true. It's almost like you like
That's
rhyming
it.
Or something.
Yeah, you know, a little bit.
It's not like he I was known for that. No, he's good. I have to admit, I haven't been...
No, he is.
I was never particularly exposed to him as a child. I was more Spot the Dog and Asterix, but still, it still sort of.
You should check
through.
Him out when. Very good. Yes, when Ben is a little bit older, you should check him out properly, because there's nothing lovelier than reading out some of his rhymes to 3-4 year olds, because they piss themselves laughing, and it doesn't mean anything. But I did it with the nephew, and it just made me kind of realise that it's not about meaning anything necessarily. Yeah. It's about the sound. It just sounds fun. Mm. So anyway, which I guess is quite appropriate, because you know we're talking about learning, and learning should be fun.
The best kind
of learning should be fun.
Which is strange, because unfortunately, the vast majority of my learning experiences up until A-level, in fact, probably even beyond A-level, were still in the... I mean, there were, don't get me wrong, it wasn't all of them, but there were quite a lot of learn this, learn that, blah, 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 blah.
And you're like, yeah, definitely.
Which is a real pity, because I think that, you know, if you gave them a bit more money and a bit more time and a little less... you know, beatings from the top down, then I suspect that, you know, teachers could work miracles with the current generation. So,
yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that going on, and I think fundamentally part of the problem is that it's just that actually kids don't really see the value that some do. Don't get me wrong, and I had, you know, I was a bit like you. A lot of the learning I did at school, it just felt like, why tell me again why I'm learning a dead language? Because you might one day be a vet. I can guarantee you I am not going to be a vet. But so I think they're sort of I understand why kids have to go to school and learn, but it's kind of, it's the wrong way around, because I think the older you get, the more you recognize the value of it and the pleasure of it as well, actually. And it's interesting, because at the moment I'm trying to get back into learning to play the piano. And I played piano for about 6 years when I was at school, and did a music GCSE and all sorts, and got to quite a good standard, and then did that thing that you do when you're a teenager and, you know, other things crop up and you just stop. And for a while I've been sort of thinking about it, and I treated myself to electronic sort of piano last year, and kind of fully expected to go back in and be able to play exactly how I was able to play 20 years ago. Weirdly, that's not the case.
It's funny that, isn't it? It's really annoying as well.
Yes, it is really annoying. And it's taken me quite a bit of time, actually, to realise that that's sort of the point. And that if it were just me sitting down and doing it all, don't get me wrong, I wasn't like a, you know, virtuoso or anything at all. But I wouldn't. It would just, if it was that easy, then why would I have given up, and B, why bother kind of going back into it? So I've sort of had to kind of reframe the way I look at it, and that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
But it's really funny, because I can really feel, it sounds really weird, I can really feel like the edges of my brain when I'm trying to learn. Basically, I've been trying to learn the same piece of music for 6 months. It's ridiculous. Largely, probably taken that long because I don't practice every day, and I should. Okay. So there's still a bit of me that's 16 years old.
Yeah.
But I can feel like when I get into it and it's hard, I can feel it's like, because your brain, I think, the whole of you gets less flexible, doesn't it, when you get older. and I can really feel it when I'm trying to play the piano.
I like the idea that you're playing the piano wrong and you are literally putting your fingers into your brain and going, oh no, there's the edges.
Yeah.
It's quite the mental image. But I've never learned to play anything particularly except for the recorder. I think I did try guitar, but yeah, I never really got very far with it.
Right.
I can touch type though, so I'm hoping that at some point that will be a transferable skill.
What are you going to transfer it to?
Piano playing. I assume it's the same thing.
I think there's a lot of sense in this.
Sometimes there is sense there, yes.
I don't mean to sound shocked.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm fairly shocked by it too.
I think you're right. And actually, that was another big realization for me coming back to the piano, was that music's a language. Mm. And I think if I loved languages when I was at school. And I think if I had realised that sooner, I might have found some aspects of it a little bit easier.
Did you want to be a translator at some point, or am I making?
Yeah, that? Blimey, where did you drag that piece of information?
I have no idea.
Yeah, no, I was.
Obviously learned
I admit,
it at
I was,
some point.
Yes, I had every intention of going to university and doing a degree in Spanish and business studies. Mm. With the intent or the sort of vague aim. I wouldn't necessarily call it a career goal because it turns out I don't really plan my career. But that was kind of what I vaguely thought I wanted to be. Mm. And then changed my mind.
Well, that's okay. Everybody can change their mind and they have to learn that that's okay.
Yes, that's very true, actually. and quite important, actually, because I think a lot of people go through... I mean, obviously, at GCSE level and to an extent A level, although you have a bit more freedom. Up until that point, you have very little choice at all. And I remember with GCSEs, this sort of arbitrary grouping where if you picked a subject from that group, you couldn't pick any other subjects from that group, which cut off, which was actually, I think I mentioned this a couple of episodes ago, was actually the reason why I didn't end up doing computing, because I think I wanted to do music, which was just random. But I think it is really important that I know people who've sort of been to university and kind of got there, and it wasn't quite, the subject matter wasn't quite what they were expecting. It's a really tough thing to say, actually, I don't want to be doing this. This isn't what I signed up for. And I think that people sort of worry that it's going to sort of, I don't know, reflect badly on them or something. Mm. It's tricky. But I liked my A-levels. Mm. I did like my A-levels. I liked it more when I did my English, because then I really felt like I was actually studying something I really properly got.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I it's funny, I have always enjoyed history and stuff, but and it was one of my favourite things at school on one level, and yet at the same time really wasn't, because I was forced to sort of study bits of history that I wasn't particularly excited by. And I absolutely love being able to just go, oh, I'll just find out about that, and just sort of pick and choose. It does mean that I'm jack of all trades, master of none on that front, but I quite like... The fact that history is now so much more accessible than it ever has been before.
Yeah,
and I know we probably shouldn't plug other people's podcasts, but never mind. Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, if you haven't tried it, is amazing.
Oh, really?
The man is fantastic. He releases like four a year, and they're each like 4 hours long.
Oh, really?
And they're and he's just really good at sort of giving you ideas about what it was like in a particular time period. His latest one was on the the Kings of Persia, which I didn't really know much about.
Oh, yeah.
And that was
pretty
cool.
I know nothing about it.
I know nothing.
I know nothing.
He did World War One and the Mongols and Rome. Oh. It's all good fun. It's really interesting stuff, and he's quite good fun to listen to as well.
Yeah, yeah. I for one, am going to go and check it out.
Absolutely.
So, nice piece of plugging.
Yeah, thank you.
did you used to have to do that weird... It's not weird. I get why they were doing it, but did you have to do that thing when you were in your history classes where you used to have to spend like half an hour, 45 minutes staring at a painting and trying to work out why the girl in the front row, the kind of social level of the different people in Did they ever make you do that kind of thing?
No, that doesn't sound... Yeah, no.
I think... I can't remember what it was. There was like... they had a name for the kind of learning it was. And
okay.
We did a lot of the Industrial Revolution, which at the time... people are going to shout at me, but at the time I thought was the most boring thing ever.
Yeah.
I don't think that now.
No, absolutely. But at the
time, the other class were doing the French Revolution, and I'm like, so you get to chop people's heads off with guillotines, and I get steam engines.
Yeah.
But I just remember how these classes where we used to have to stare at these really dull paintings of like, you know, and work out, I don't know, whether it was the feudal system or the, do you know what I mean? And I just, it really, because I loved history too, and I love reading and sort of listening to it now and kind of watching things. But it got squashed.
Yeah.
Because of the manner in which it was taught. I think that's a big aspect of whether you fall in love with something or not.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's the issue with any form of learning that's not led by your own interest, is that it can become a chore quite quickly. And, you know, I mean, like, Shakespeare at school is probably the key one where, yes, Shakespeare is amazing. There are no two ways about it. But being forced to sit in class and, you know, read it out and just be like, I don't really understand what I'm saying, and now I'm going to have to talk about this paragraph for the next hour and a half, and I don't care anymore. And, you know, whereas actually the best thing to do would be to go, right, we're spending a month going to the theatre, obviously completely implausible, but, you know, and then we're going to come back and chat about it after we've seen it, you know.
Instead of
making you read it first, just go, right, this is it, what did you reckon? And then pull it apart and go, right, what was your favourite bit? Right, okay, tell me about it. And you know, getting people impassioned about it rather than, you know, beating them over the head with language that they don't quite get because they don't have any context for it.
Yeah, absolutely, and kind of just killing all the joy out of it. This is not going to reflect well on me either, but I had one of my modules at university was a Shakespeare module, which I decided to stop going to because the guy teaching it was just killing it.
Well, no,
sorry.
No, I was going to say that it's not something to be ashamed of or anything. That's, you know.
Oh, I maybe should have pressed, but anyway, I remember sitting there in the last class I went to and thinking, if I keep coming here, I love Shakespeare and I love reading it as much as I love seeing it on stage, and you're just ruining it.
Well, I sort of came out of school with the general standard sort of thing of about Shakespeare, with the occasional bright light of having my mum took us to go and see Shakespeare at the Globe. We saw Henry V, and that was amazing.
Yes.
So that was the only sort of glimpse that I had about what Shakespeare could be, kind of, because I'd been to a couple of other things down at the RSC and at the National Theatre, and they'd all been a bit staid and a bit sort of, you know, a bit sort of like, and you're like, well, which works, don't get me wrong, because, you know, that gives you people like Ian McKellen and stuff, but...
You just made me think of Blackadder.
Yes, I was thinking that too. First the stance, now the roar. Don't mention the Scottish play.
Don't mention the Scottish play.
What? Macbeth? But that's the sort of way that makes people interested in it. Because I always remember... after that, I was always a bit like, ugh, you know, can't really be bothered with Shakespeare. And there was Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, and that was great because it had Claire Danes in it and, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
And Leo, don't forget Leo.
Well, I wasn't really there for him, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
But generally speaking, it was one of those sort of things of me sort of going, you know, about it.
Yeah.
And then I picked up a book by Bill Bryson called Shakespeare.
Oh, yes.
And it's only 200 pages long, I think.
Yeah.
And it's great because it goes into his history and what life was like then and why we don't know very much about him. And, like, you know, we only have seven of his... The only things that we have handwritten by him that we can definitely prove are seven signatures.
Yes, yes.
And none of them are spelled Shakespeare.
No. You are talking to the woman who went to the British Museum Shakespeare exhibition
four times.
Four times.
Excellent. Well, yeah, it, and that.
I'm a little bit obsessed, but yes, no, it is. It's fascinating. And I, having said that, I've never read the Bill Bryson book, and I need to.
It's fun. I mean, the nice thing is that he starts off going, you know, I know there are millions of books on Shakespeare, and the reason that this one's quite so short is because we really don't know much about him.
Sure.
And, you know, and then goes, you know, there's wonderful bits about London Bridge and how apparently once a whale got stuck under it.
Did it? Good Lord.
Apparently so, which makes you go, that's cool.
That is cool.
And how lethal it was to try and go under it with a boat and stuff, because if you went under it in a boat, because there were lots of sort of pylons going down, or not pylons, but pillars going down into the riverbed, obviously the river speeds up as you go through it, so if you get it wrong, you get stuffed into a stone column and then washed away.
Ouch. Yeah. Nasty.
But the bridge itself was its own city and stuff. It's awesome, you know.
It's like a mile and a bit long. I got to see Benedict Cucumber Patch in when he did Hamlet, and it was and I've seen a lot of good Shakespeare.
Yeah,
but it was the first time I've ever seen a piece of Shakespeare where it felt like the person was talking, if you see what I mean,
rather than
performing it.
Yeah,
and it was eye-opening, actually. Yeah. I mean, he was staggering. The reviews were good for a very good reason, I think, because it just you almost forgot you were watching a piece of Shakespeare and just were kind of absorbed in the play. It didn't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's always there's so much that's attached to a Shakespearean play. That was pretty amazing.
Mm. And that sounds exactly what you want, really, isn't it? Because
yeah,
I think that was what I got from going to the Globe, was that it was a very different style of Shakespeare. It wasn't the sort of, shh, sit down and watch and absorb, this is important. It was very much more like pantomime, almost.
Yes.
Although there was a certain amount of realism to it. They were still declaiming to the crowd and using us as the, you know, when he was doing the St. Crispin's Day speech, he's shouting that to us as his army, and that was awesome.
Oh,
especially
wow.
Since I was stood at the edge of the stage with my arms crossed on it, watching them. So I was literally feet away from the guy, and I was just like, yeah, okay, fair enough, let's go and trash some Frenchies. And they figured out all of the sort of the puns about the Welsh and the Irish that are in there, and they'd found where the Welsh people were sitting, and they, you know, would regularly wave leeks at them and stuff, and you know, and it completely changes the experience, and you go, oh right, this is why it was popular. You know, it's not stuffy and weird. It's you know, it's real and it's good and it's, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it must be one of the reasons. And sometimes they're done very, very well, and a lot of times I think they're done sort of tokenistically. But
yes,
it must be one of the reasons why the history programmes on TV regularly have actors in them now.
Because
I guess it does help to say, sometimes I think they do them very well. Sometimes I just think, why?
Yeah.
It sort of helps bring it to life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, I've certainly noticed that people are more engaged with the idea of history, although history isn't the main thing that we're talking about, obviously, is learning, because of things like Game of Thrones and the Tudors and Rome and, you know, all of these things that bring that bit of history to life, and you can get into it and you go, oh, these people are still the same as us.
Yes.
It's just the circumstances that are different. And, you know, and I know Game of Thrones is obviously fictional, but it's, you know...
But historical fiction plays a huge role, I think, in people's understanding of these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, the very best historical fiction is able to sort of blend the important facts and yet still tell a kind of universal story that might not be completely... I think it's truthful, not necessarily 100% accurate. And in literary terms, I mean, Hilary Mantel has sort of changed the goalposts a little bit in that sense, because for a long time, historical fiction was seen as a sort of bit of a, you know, I mean, it is obviously a genre in its own right, and it was sort of seen as a bit, I think, as being a bit sort of, what's the word, just a bit sort of this, I'm saying it like this, I don't think this, but a bit commercial.
Yeah.
You know, it's in there with the thrillers and the crime fiction, and I love all of those things. Mm. But people get a bit sniffy about it because it's not literary.
Yeah.
And actually, I think whether she meant to or not, Hilary Mantel has kind of changed that a little bit because everybody's gone, oh, hang on a minute, we thought you were a literary fiction writer and you've written a historical novel. Mm. But she's kind of meticulous. I mean, Cromwell is another one where we don't know a huge amount. I mean, we know everyone knows the basic facts.
Yeah.
But she's had to go in and sort of put her own interpretation on what she thinks is going on, particularly sort of within his inner emotional life.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting.
Mm. I think that's the thing, isn't it? Is connecting people, you know, people to the people who were there at the time.
Yeah.
But and you know, with other forms of learning, again, it's somehow getting you to connect to whatever you're talking about. I mean, like, I don't get maths. I never have.
No.
I'm awful with numbers.
Yep.
But I am fascinated by, and this is why, unfortunately, my science is mainly from pop science books, because that's my level. Because I can't do the maths to get any further into it. But, you know, I'm fascinated by the idea that people can use it, like you said, with music, as a language.
Yes.
And somebody points at a set of squiggles and numbers and letters on a blackboard and go, and that describes basically about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And you look at it and you go, where?
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where you go, I don't get what that means. But when you break it down and say, well, but we can test that because of XYZ, and we do this.
Yeah.
And I can get that, and I go, oh, okay. Which is why I have a deep, abiding love for the Science Museum and places like that.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, it can show you the things that you don't quite necessarily get otherwise.
Well, I think this, again, school is such a sort of mixed bag of experience for most people. Because I have exactly the same problem as you. I cannot do the maths.
Mm.
And
the
they're
maths.
The maths. and therefore told myself that I was rubbish at science.
Mm.
And to a degree, I am, because I can't do the maths. And I just, but that doesn't mean that you can't be interested and still learn stuff. And I love astronomy and try. Say there is a big problem because it does involve quite a lot of numbers, but it doesn't stop you from kind of reading about other astronomers. I'm reading a book at the moment by Darva Sobel, who wrote Longitude.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if you've come across that book, but it was she wrote the sort of seminal book on, I forget the guy, was it Harrison's clock that actually helped them pinpoint longitude, because you needed an accurate clock.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah,
but it was all about the sort of quest for perfect longitude.
Mm.
Anyway, she's written a book called The Glass Universe, I think, about the role that a group of women played in better understanding the stars and astronomy. And the reason I was telling it, this just popped into my head, was because I've just been listening to, because I'm listening to it on Audible, and she was talking about a male astronomer who basically had declared into the late 1880s that there was nothing else to learn about the stars.
Yeah. But that's quite a late 1880s thing to say about science. You know, we've pretty much finished everything. It's not like there's anything smaller out there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's talking about this lady who I've forgotten her name, but one of the ladies, they were sort of largely employed to study photographic plates of star systems.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
really interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
And they were called computers. These ladies were called computers, which is really, really fun.
Mm.
But they were sort of brought in. A chap called Pickering was at Harvard, and he sort of ran the observatory, and he put out this open call for people to come and help him sort of study. I think initially a lot of it was obviously done through the telescope and kind of writing the numbers down and comparing the numbers.
Mm.
And then as kind of photography got better and better, they realized that they could actually see a huge amount more by studying the photographs. And so there's quite a big group of women who are involved in that process. And it was just really brilliant, because the book sort of says this lady, whose name I've forgotten, was just sort of this chap had declared there was nothing else to learn, and you know, she just had all these huge questions in her head that you would like to think you would have had in yours.
Yeah.
Versus this chap who's just gone, nah, nothing to see here.
No, it's all good. And I like to think that they all speak like that. No.
And the fact that they, you know, and he's not the only one, as you said, but the fact that they were so wrong, and actually that we are probably, we're in a sort of similar situation, I guess, with sort of digital technology. Mm. I mean, I think we've pretty much come to accept now that I think we realise that there's still so much we don't understand. I mean, the brain is a really interesting example, isn't it? We know so little about the brain. But I think when you're in your time period, you don't necessarily see the significance of.
Yes, yeah, I would love to go 200 years into the future and see what we got right, what we got wrong, and which bits were actually the turning points.
Yes, absolutely. You know,
because it's only what at the end of World War II that you suddenly go, oh look, because Einstein's stuff all suddenly turns into a bomb, and everyone goes, oh, that's what he meant.
Yes. You know. Yes, and some are really clear. You can see, you know, I mean, I think it must have been pretty evident pretty quickly that the steam engine was fundamentally changing the world in the same way that I think you can see how very clearly how the internet has changed the world in our lifetime. But yeah, there are other sort of subtler ones that, like you say, it'd be fascinating to kind of see which ones are the ones that you know, because I guess it's the ones that are going to surprise you, that are probably going to be have the biggest impact.
Pop-Tarts did what?
to be Marty McFly with your DeLorean.
Absolutely, especially I saw one of them on the day that they go to in Back to the Future 2. This guy was driving it round Uttoxeter. I was like,
wow,
that was quite cool.
An actual DeLorean.
I was like, my god, it went round a corner and it basically almost fell off the road. I was like, wow, that is not a good car, but at the same time, so cool.
I know, good lord. Was this recent?
Yeah, that was 20. When did they go to? Was it 2015?
Oh,
I should know this. It was the day they go to in Back.
It
to
was
the
yes, it was 20. Yes, it was
so
November.
It must have been a while ago.
Isn't it November 4th, 2015?
That sounds about right.
I think it is, because it's definitely 2015, because I wanted to have a Back to the Future party, but our extension work on our house was happening, and so I couldn't do it.
Yes.
November. Was it?
Going to find it. I'm Googling madly.
Shall I start my whistling?
No. Yeah, it was November. October 21st, 2015.
Oh, of course it was.
I should have known that, but never mind. But yeah, so that went past. I was like,
I'm quite jealous.
And at the same time, I did think to myself, the most unrealistic part of the whole movie, apart from Doc Brown being shot at close range with an AK-47 that then jams. AK-47s do not jam. You can run tanks over them and they still work. You throw them in mud and they still work. You fill them with sand and they still work. But the most unrealistic bit was when he goes, let's see if you like 90, and pushes it to 90 inside of a car park. Having watched that one go, no. I very much doubt any DeLorean has ever made it to 90, especially not in a car park. But, you know, so...
Brilliant.
That's what happens when you make a car of solid steel.
Yes, indeed. Yes. So learning.
Yes, sorry. No, Back to the Future. Back to the Future is all about learning.
I'm tempted to just carry on down the Back to the Future chat. I was going to say, I mean, I don't know whether you've, I mean, sort of asked whether, do you kind of ever find yourself wanting to kind of go and do it in a formal sense, or do you just sort of actually just enjoy it in terms of kind of reading and like just going to sort of museums and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are the occasions when I go, oh yeah, that would be nice to sort of do properly, because there is that sort of thing that when you're doing it casually by yourself and you're just reading something or going to a museum, you skip around and you pick up bits and you know, like I say, become jack of all trades, master of none. But when you study something, you kind of know it afterwards. Or at least, well, maybe not know it afterwards. I don't remember many things from my first time at uni, but never mind. except for the counselling stuff. That's been useful.
Yeah,
But I couldn't tell you most of the things that I learned in theatre studies, apart from the fact that there were a lot of dead Russians involved.
It's important. That's an important piece of information.
Yeah, I can remember the names Stanislavski. I remember him. He was the beginning of realism. I remember Bertolt Brecht, who wanted to start revolution through.
Didn't he want to break the fourth wall?
He did break the fourth wall. There was no fourth wall.
There we are.
So he would make people only be part of the play when they were in like a certain section of the stage and stuff. So he was always trying to make you realize that you were watching a play, and the play was the message, and the message was go out and become communists and start a revolution. And then there was someone called Grotowski. Can't remember what he was all about. But Stanislavski led to the method, basically. Method acting sort of has a direct link back to that. That's about all I remember. There you go.
I love the fact that the pug is just deeply uninterested.
Yes, she's snoring in the background.
She's like, I don't care about your theatre studies.
No, exactly. I didn't really care about my theatre studies either. Though it did give me the opportunity to do a student initiated module when they told me, by the way, you need to do a student initiated module and you've got a month. And I went, And Lord of the Rings had just come out at the cinema, The Fellowship of the Ring. And so I managed to twist their arm that there were three separate performances of Gandalf, and I could do an interesting bit of writing about how they all differed. So I did the animated Gandalf from the early, mid-80s. I did the Ian Holm Gandalf from the audio play, the audio thing from the early 80s on BBC, and I did Ian McKellen's Gandalf. And somehow I got a fairly decent mark with that. I do not know how I wrangled that one.
You just reminded me of my last year at UD when I realised that because where I studied the English literature, they I don't know if they still do this, but they give the essay questions out quite early, and you kind of decide which modules you need to turn up to based on which essay question you think you're going to answer at the end of the year. And I'd kind of figured this out in the second year, and then in the third year I then realized that if I was to look at the suggested reading list for whichever module I was going to write about and then found the most obscure book possible, it was quite likely that I might get a slightly better mark I can't think of my words today, but for not ingenuity, but that, you know what I mean.
Yeah, for just being standing out from the crowd slightly.
Yeah. Hmm. Anyway, I surpassed myself in one particular essay where it turned out that there was a book on the reading list that was only available in one university library in the whole of the United Kingdom.
Wow.
And this book happened to be at Bristol University Library, and I happened to have friends at Bristol University Library. So I asked a friend to go and get this book out of their library. I borrowed it. I read the first 50 pages and the last 50 pages of what was probably about 600 or 700 pages, wrote an essay, got a first.
Wow.
And hopefully no one from my university is listening, because they might they might want my first back.
They might.
I mean, it was only in that one essay. So hey kids, the lesson here is but it occurred to me that if there was only one in the entire country, then it was quite possible that my lecturer wouldn't have read it either. So, I mean, I don't know that. I may also have written a decent essay. Who knows? But it just, it was. I'm not sure I'm sending out the best message for how to go about a university career.
No, I think you are, though, because I think the thing is that learning is all about learning the system that you're learning within. You know,
practical life skills, cut corners.
It's not about cutting corners, though, is it? It's about learning the most efficient way to work a system.
Yes, and I also actually you made a point just then, which is a really serious point, which is about standing out from other people. So I've told you before, I also did a Robin Hood module, and I remember everybody around me, all the girls, wanted to do the Maid Marian question. And I was just like, why would you do that? Because your lecturer is going to have 50 versions of the same flipping essay. So it's got to be a really good essay.
Yeah.
If you're going to get a decent mark. And so I think I went for the one about whether Robin Hood was gay or not. Mm. Again, based on a book that you could only get in America. And as luck would have it, Mum was on holiday in America at the time. And I sent her, I must have sent her an email, because I didn't have a mobile. So I must have sent her an email or something saying, can you go to Barnes & Noble and get me this book? And she did. I still have it.
Amazing.
It was... so I think there is a serious point to all of this, is that actually, and I sort of have always sort of felt like this since I've got more comfortable in my own skin, is why would I want to be like everyone else? That might just be weird stubbornness.
Well, but that again, it's a different sort of learning, isn't it? It's learning who you are in that case, which is almost the most important learning.
That's so deep, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you ever just looked at your hand, man, and just thought, wow?
Oh, regularly.
Yeah.
Although I look at my hands now and go, God, you look like you've got old lady hands.
you should give crone's them back hands. At some point.
But what, to the old lady?
Yeah.
It's right, my feet are catching up now as well. Oh, okay. I've got old lady feet. It's just...
If you have crone's hands, I'm hoping that you're going to get like a hump and long, long grey hair and be like, on a regular basis.
I would love that. I would love to be one of those old ladies who scares children in their local community.
That would be amazing. Could you base yourself on Madame Mim from the
Yes, exactly.
Oh, Merlin! I love her.
I love Madame Mim.
She's brilliant.
I think I was... That's the Sword in the Stone, right?
Yes, it is,
Yes, which I think was on TV at Christmas, and I'd forgotten it. And I was like, I love this film! Oh, mostly for Madame Mim.
The wizard jewel is probably one of my favourite things ever, just them turning into various animals
and
trying to stomp each other.
Yes, and I can't remember who voices Merlin.
I do not know, but I can find out for you. I have this amazing tool, it's called the internet. I hear it's going to change things.
It's probably going to take, if you're not careful, it'll take to Wikipedia as well.
Yes.
Which actually, I mean, I know you have to be a touch careful with Wikipedia, but has totally changed everyone's world in terms of learning things. I mean, I have...
Carl Swenson, apparently.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought it was somebody I'd heard of, but no. Apparently not.
It's a good, he's a good voice, though.
He is an excellent voice. But, you know, I have a friend
Martha Wentworth was Madame Mim.
Oh, okay.
She was apparently the old lady squirrel as well. Who knew? Oh.
Not me.
Yeah, it looks
there
like...
There we are. We have all learned something today.
She was also in 101 Dalmatians. Thank you, IMDb.
Another amazing resource.
I've only seen 101 Dalmatians once or twice, but yeah.
I didn't mean 101 Dalmatians was an amazing resource.
Well, she was Nanny, Queenie, and Lucy.
Oh, so okay. There you go. I meant IMDb, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, I gathered that, but I was just being silly. I know it's unusual. I know.
Although I have been known to take life lessons from Pixar movies, so, you know.
Well, but Pixar is a life lesson, as far as I can tell, isn't it? I mean, like the company itself.
Yes. Have you ever read Creativity Inc.?
I haven't, no, but I've seen a few documentaries about them, and it's just, you know, when LucasArts sold them off and went, nobody's going to want CGI, and then 10 years later, I go, shit.
Yes, yeah. So Creativity Inc. is really interesting. It's by the head dude Ed Catmull, it's just really interesting. It sort of talks about their philosophy and how they and sort of pertinent to this, kind of how they learnt as they went.
Yeah.
You know, and when they decided they were going to do Toy Story, they had absolutely no idea
how
complicated a task they had set themselves, and sort of learning the mechanics of storytelling and placing that above all else, and then there's some really interesting stuff in there because Steve Jobs was heavily involved with them for a long time, and just that was quite fascinating because they obviously there's obviously a lot of tenderness there, but Catmull also doesn't pull any punches either.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an honest, from, I presume, from his point of view, it's an honest account of, of somebody who's taken on fairly mythological proportions, really, because of, because of his time at Apple. You know, very, very driven, very difficult, pain in the backside to work for, but was your biggest fan if he believed in what you were doing. Which is pretty amazing. Yeah, really interesting book, actually.
Fun fact about Toy Story, Will Wheaton worked on it just briefly, which I quite like. So,
I didn't know that.
Wesley Crusher helped with that a bit.
In what fashion?
I think he was, I want to say he was an animator for them, just briefly.
Really?
But yeah, no, I remember that from, I saw him on stage in London when I was about 14 at a Star Trek convention. And he was like, oh yeah, I was involved in Toy Story. I was like, ha, who knew? Because somebody said, what have you been doing since Star Trek? And he was like, well, I worked on Toy Story. And you're like, ooh. And that was after the really awkward moment where this was in the Royal Albert Hall. So obviously you can't see particularly well from the stage. And somebody way up in the back had got hold of the microphone and was asking questions, because that was what we were at that point, was questions from the audience.
Yeah.
And this woman up at the back went, have you got a kiss for your mother, Wesley? And he looked up and he couldn't really see her. Everyone else could sort of see that she was dressed as Dr. Crusher. And he was just like, what? It's just one of those moments of, what the fuck? You know. And I really enjoyed that. It was just so awkward. It was brilliant. He finally got it. He was like, oh, yeah, hi, Mum.
Oh, no, oh, bless him. He is one of the best things about The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We done!
Yeah, so I know. I did not know that. Very good.
The other thing I learned that day, Captain Sisko, or Avery Brooks, the guy who played Captain Sisko in Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yes. Insane.
Completely mad.
Oh, really?
Utterly mad. He would occasionally just stop talking, laugh, and then start singing. It was mad. And he was standing there, because he's a jazz singer, apart from anything else.
Oh, is he?
He would occasionally just be like, and then just break out into like scooby doo boop 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 doop boop, and you're like, the hell is going on?
Oh, that's awesome. You've just, not that I spend my life watching Big Bang Theory, but you just reminded me of another bit with James L. Jones.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Where Sheldon has his tendency to stalk famous actors in things like Star Trek and Star Wars, and is standing over him at his dinner table, and James Earl Jones says, do you like Star Wars? And you think, oh, this is going to be awkward and embarrassing, and Sheldon can't speak, and he's nodding, and James Earl Jones just goes, I do too! And it's just, I in my head, that is, I've decided that is how James Earl Jones is.
Yeah, I think
I don't know if
close.
It's true.
I think it's pretty close, yeah. He seems to be great fun.
And then they go and play Knockdown Ginger with the amazing Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
In her dressing gown.
Oh, she's awesome. We keep coming back round to her, but as we should do. She helped with a lot of learning about stuff.
Yeah.
Mental health, Star Wars, being a strong female, being a leader.
Yeah, being funny.
Being funny.
Just being
comfortable being uncomfortable, maybe.
Yes, in your own skin. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, actually. I think that's I like that.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, learning. Yeah, man.
It's all good. Well, I, for one, have learnt stuff today.
Yes, me too.
I'm not entirely... Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I just waffled.
No, I've learnt many things. Like, if I need to stand out, I need to get books from America.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, life lessons at university. How to cheat the system.
Exactly. And if you really want to stand out, you need to write about how Robin Hood is gay, regardless of the subject.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I've learned many things. So do we have a hero of learning? I would like to put forward Andrew Marr, because although I don't necessarily agree with everything he does, the man is annoyingly good at learning things. He is a polyglot of the highest order. As another plug, which I wish I got money for this, because I recommend this all the time, his book, A History of the World, is amazing.
Yeah.
Really good. It gives you a really good overview of world history. So you know how quite often you'll be like, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and you're like, wait, but you don't get the thing of, in Elizabethan England, this was happening. In the same time in China and Japan, this is happening. And down in Africa, we think this is happening, but we don't have, you know, and it really ties everything together. So it's not necessarily completely specific in it. It's not going to teach you massive amounts about a individual subject, but it gives you a real feeling for the ebbs and flows of history in a global sense. It's really good fun.
Yeah,
really interesting. And also the audible narrator is fantastic.
Oh, that's interesting, because I have a credit available this month, so you've just decided me what I'm going to go.
I recommend it highly enough. It got me through a 17-mile training walk when I first got it, and I've listened to it about 4 times since then. That was about 2 years ago. So.
Wow, crikey, that is good. That is a good book.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, Andrew Marr it is then.
Yeah, cool. So,
excellent.
Go out and go forth and learn.
Yes.
Learn whatever you like. Learn it as well as you like it, because that's the important thing.
Yes, just enjoy yourself whilst doing it, if you possibly can.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you're having to learn pot washing or something, that's never
fun. Or, you know, GCSE physics. We've been there. We feel your pain, but you've got to do it.
Just remember, if somebody says, what's physics, you can always take out a nail and a hammer, hit it, and just go, ta-da. They can't argue with that.
Very good.
And on that note, I think we should probably
stop
the teaching. Yeah. Cool. So I have been Matt, and it is goodbye from me.
And I have been Lisa, and bye-bye for now.
And we shall see you next time on Cousins of Hope.
For more Mosaic content, please visit us at facebook.com/hubrismosaic.